Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. American plasma is the lifeblood of a global medical industry. The biggest players are foreign-owned, but they depend on the United States for their crude material, cheaply obtained blood plasma, which they process into life-saving, expensive drugs. It's an industry that's out in the open, but it's also partially hidden. Kathleen McLaughlin went looking and asking questions. The journalist authored the book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. And Kathleen McLaughlin, welcome to The Source.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you on. I'm excited to talk about this. Our number, if you got a question, a comment, if you've been a person who's participated in this industry, either by becoming a person who's sold your blood plasma, or if you're a person who depends on the products made from other people selling their blood plasma, give us a call. We want to hear your story. How do you see this process? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can tweet at us at TPRSource. Send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. And you can text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. And Kathleen, when we talk about people who need these products, that would include you, right?
Yeah. So for the last 20 years, off and on, I have had required periodic infusions of a drug that is made from other people's plasma. So this is actually a very personal story for me. I have a rare autoimmune condition, and the treatment for my disease is a drug called human immunoglobulin, which is made from other people's plasma. So this is kind of what launched me on this quest, was wondering where my drug came from and who the donors were that made it.
So let's help. I mean, it's kind of confusing to me. I was like, okay, there's blood and there's blood plasma, but what's the difference?
Yeah, it was confusing to me in the beginning as well. So blood is blood. We all know what blood is. Plasma is the protein component of blood. So when you separate plasma out of blood, it's a kind of a yellowish, watery liquid, and it's essentially just the protein part of your blood. The other parts are the white and red cells and the platelets. When you donate plasma, the other parts are re-infused back into your body, and they just keep this yellowish protein liquid.
And so to do that, it requires, okay, I guess it's an 18-gauge needle. That's like, to me, that sounds like the size of a bass string. It's pretty big, you know? So,
I mean, I think it's big. When I have my infusions of my medication, they use a much smaller needle. The 18-gauge seems big to me. If you talk to donors, I think people get used to it. To me, it seems big. They always go into the crook of your arm with these, where there's that big, fat, juicy vein that most people have. So, it seems like a big vein to me. And part of it is they're pulling the blood out and then they're reinfusing the cells back in after they extract the plasma.
But they also add a compound when they put it back into your system, an anticoagulant, anti-clotting drug, so they can put the cells back in. And so there's a concern about that.
That substance is something that a lot of donors have been concerned about, if there are any health effects from that. Some people have suspected that that makes them a little bit sick. There isn't really much evidence on that end, because there hasn't been a ton of scientific study about what it does to you, but there is a citrate that is re-injected back in to keep the blood from coagulating.
Yeah, we'll get into that see no evil, hear no evil mindset that seems to be existing, looking at the long-term health impacts of being a donor. But let's talk about the people who do donate and why they do. And that's really what your book is about. You go and search and you talk to over 100 people who are donors, people who are involved in the industry. You get their story, you find out who they are. And it's surprising who some of them, you know, we all know college students are part of this, but, you know, we see who else is that. But, you know, how much money, well, can they make if they decide, well, I'm going to go sell my blood plasma?
So it really depends where in the United States you live, and it depends how often you go. So it's not an entirely transparent system for people, I would say, and the companies incentivize coming back as often as possible. The maximum that you can donate is twice a week. The companies would like you to donate twice a week. So the way they structure these payments is designed to encourage that. So for example, you might go on Tuesday and donate plasma and get $40. If you return on Friday, you'd get $50 for the second payment. If you make all eight times in a month, you might get a month-end bonus. If you make a certain number of weeks in a row, you can get a bonus. They really incentivize it so that you're coming back a maximum number of times possible. So I would say that it's hard to kind of calculate an average because it does vary regionally. I would say most people who are doing it and they're doing it at the maximum amount might be making between $600 or $700 a month. I have seen the amount up to as high as $1,200 a month, and that's during periods of plasma shortages. So, for example, when the U.S.-Mexico border was closed during the pandemic, they were offering $1,200 a month for people to donate at the border collection stations. And that's because Mexican citizens at that time were not able to come into the U.S. to donate. And that's a major demographic of people who do sell plasma in the U.S. So it's very interesting to me because it's such a commodity, almost like oil or anything else, that the pricing is established as such. But you can't really say, oh, you can make $500 a month selling plasma. It really does vary on so many different factors.
So that gamification of the price of how much they're willing to pay you, it's done, I'm sure they've consulted with some social engineering experts to figure out what can we do to hook people into giving as frequently as they can do this without compromising their health. That is, it does that in and of itself. It smacks of there's something fishy going on here. I mean, am I wrong?
I mean, it smacks of that to me. One of the things that is very striking to me in all of this is you can donate plasma at the Red Cross and not get paid. You know, we all know about donating blood to the Red Cross. If you have a certain blood type, the Red Cross wants your plasma for different kinds of medical treatments. They limit the maximum number of plasma donations in a year to 13. So you can only donate unpaid at the Red Cross 13 times a year. If you donate plasma at a for-profit center, you can do it up to 104 times a year. So it's just a massive gap in between what is considered safe and allowed by a nonprofit organization that's well-respected as opposed to what is considered safe and allowed by companies who are making profit off of this. So it's really, and just the fact that the pay structure isn't transparent and it is designed to get people to come in and come back and come back, that says something fishy to me as well.
We're going to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation talking about the book Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. Speaking with Kathleen McLaughlin. She is an experienced journalist, award-winning journalist, and she's here to take your calls and questions about what's going on in the plasma industry. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the book Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. We're joined by Kathleen McLaughlin, and she has been telling us about how much they pay people to come in, and get a big needle that's stuck in their arm, and they will remove your blood and your plasma, but they'll put your blood back, and then they will give you like a debit card loaded with a bit of money. And it varies. It varies according to how often you come in and go through this process. And Kathleen, so my issue with that is, if I go to, you know, Taco Bell, the Chalupa Supreme is going to cost the same thing every time I go in. It's the fact that they will monkey around with the price is evidence to me that they are doing this in a way to try and just do keep the margins as low as possible, pay people as little as possible for this very critical commodity, this raw material that's used to make a life-saving drugs for people like you and so many others. Got a question from Robert. He texted in, how much money do corporations really make from the plasma?
Well, we're not really sure. I mean, this is, as you mentioned at the top of the show, this is a $20 billion a year industry. It's massive. The exact profits, I don't know. These are private companies. What I can tell you that maybe illustrates the gap is my medication is priced at $13,000 a dose. So it's made from other people's plasma. They're getting maybe $40 a pop for donating. Now, it's not a one-to-one equation. I'm not getting a direct infusion of one person's plasma. It's made from the parts of plasma from many different people. So there's a lot in the middle, but you're looking at a gap between $40 on one end and $13,000 on the other. So I would, like a lot of things in the American healthcare industry, there are plenty of people in the middle who are making money off of this. And it's profitable enough that the plasma companies engaged in major lawsuits to reopen the U.S.-Mexico border when it was closed to Mexican citizens coming in to sell plasma.
And that was over a visa issue. They were classifying the people. Suddenly, if you come across to sell your plasma, then you are now doing labor, which you're not supposed to do. And that shook things up quite a bit. I remember I did a story on that.
Yeah, that was really interesting to me. So you would know then that before the pandemic, there were something around 10,000 Mexican citizens a week crossing into the U.S. to sell plasma because it's a good source of income for people. And the practice is banned in Mexico, like most of the rest of the world, but it's legal in the U.S. So the way it was described to me by people who live in Mexico is kind of a don't ask, don't tell. Before the pandemic, they didn't really tell the border guards what they were doing for the day. But at the same time, it wasn't illegal. It was just kind of a little bit undercover. After the border reopened a couple of years into the pandemic, the Department of Homeland Security decided that selling plasma was actually labor. Now, labeling this act as labor would have massive implications for the entire industry, not just the borderland plasma collection centers. So the plasma company sued, and there's been this back and forth of lawsuits and decisions. At the moment, it has reopened. And I've talked to a couple of the people that I interviewed for the book who live in Juarez, Mexico. And they have gone back to donate again now that it's legal. And, you know, it's just a really good source of money for people. And now that it's no longer classified as labor that requires a special visa, they have started resuming coming back.
They have these commercial blood plasma collection centers not far from the international bridges where people can walk across maybe a block or two away. And when they open, you walk around Brownsville at that time. And there's a long line, a block long, people there waiting to sell their plasma. And they get paid good money. They can't sell it in Mexico. We can sell it in the United States. Let's go to a caller. We have Hector on the line. Hector, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I really enjoy your show, and I love listening to it almost every week. But I am a business professional. I also am a landlord and a property manager, and it's a side hustle, just like anything, and income is income. To clarify, usually if you go at the beginning of the week, it's about $40. And if you go the second end of the week, it's about $100. So yeah, it's probably about $600 a month to make. Every bit helps with this economy and the price of things. It's something that helps out the feed the family and, you know, take care of the bills. And those are my comments.
Well, Hector, thank you for calling. I appreciate your input. And I mean, it makes sense, you know, if you're in good health and you can do that, then, but you have to wonder if people are being paid for a product, what it's actually worth, Kathleen.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, I should be really clear. We have established this system in the U.S. We have kind of accidentally, I think, decided that we're okay with people paying for this. The system isn't going to go away. I have come to believe that people should get paid more than their current, and that the system should be more transparent. If this is what we're going to have, and we're going to be the biggest plasma provider in the world, and we're going to export this product to other countries that feel it's not ethical to pay people for this substance, then I think the donors should actually be treated better. And I mean, financially, and also with some transparency. So in order to make a certain amount of money, should you have to go twice a week, or should you get paid an established amount every time you go? And should there be more transparency around what you get paid? I mean, I really do feel like this act constitutes labor in a lot of ways. You know, you have to make time to do it. It takes up your time. It takes a part of your body. And I think that we should be looking at it as something that deserves more respect and potentially more income.
Do you pay taxes? I was reading just before we went on the air about some guy. He made $6,500 a year selling his plasma before taxes. So that's taxable income.
It can be if you declare it. And I think that there is some debate among people who sell plasma over whether or not that is declared. I don't think everyone who does it declares it. And again, it's in that area where is it income? Where does this money sit in terms of, you know, legal areas? So some people do declare it for taxes, and I think some people don't.
Now, how well regulated is this industry? Does a facility have to be licensed? Does it have to be frequently inspected? Is that part of the public record? Or has anyone ever been shut down because they were not doing it properly?
No, they do. They definitely do have licensing and inspections. The facilities that I have seen, in particular, the one that I went inside in Flint, Michigan, and spent an hour and a half in, is very clean, very well run. The employees are well trained. They are designed to do this process safely. They are also designed to optimize customer service, I would say. So they're really looking at employing people who keep the donors happy and keep them coming back. But the plasma industry has changed a lot since the 1980s and 1990s with the AIDS epidemic. There were several outbreaks of HIV and AIDS in our plasma system. And since then, the companies have figured out that treating plasma with heat makes it safer. Every donor now has their own centrifuge, and so you're not sharing equipment or needles with other people. So I think it is safe for donors. The thing that I've heard from people that is concerning is frequent donation tends to make people feel physically worse. So if you're prone to getting sick from donating plasma, if you're doing it twice a week, you're going to feel sick all the time. I talked with a young woman a few weeks ago after the book was written who was just kind of telling me that she had donated plasma in her early 20s, and she said she was sick for 3 years and she didn't feel better until she stopped doing it. So you hear these kinds of stories from people that it's something that makes them not feel great, makes them feel uncomfortable, but they also need to do it to get the income. And especially as Hector mentioned, right now we're in this period of inflation. Things are expensive right now. People need extra money to make ends meet. So it's an appealing proposition for a lot of people.
Could there be a federal regulations that would set the price for selling blood plasma? Could the Fed step in on that?
Well, yeah, of course they could. I mean, one of the more interesting, again, it would probably require something labeling this as labor. One of the more interesting propositions I've heard in my reporting is from Luke Schaefer at the University of Michigan, who is the head of their poverty studies program. And he thinks that we should have something called a plasma minimum wage. And that's exactly what it would be. He doesn't have a price for that. It would have to be, you know, figured out and established, but you'd be looking at a fair and transparent price for this substance rather than a variable that depends on where you live and what the demand is. Rather than treating people kind of like oil wells, they would treat it as more of an act of labor. So certainly the federal government could do something like that if they were so inclined to.
Let's go to a caller. We have Jay on the line. Jay, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to say I have done this for a long time, off and on over the years. And there are people who depend on this as far as a source of income. I've met quite a lot of people who have done it over the years. And some of them, if they didn't have it, they weren't going to be able to put gas in their car or feed their kids. Often when I was going in, it was quite the experience. It was almost as if they were like herding cattle. There were times that we were in there like 3 or 4 hours waiting, and the staff would kind of be talking to each other. When I would try to talk to a manager, they would say, this is the best we're able to do, but I know that they're getting bonuses for not having to staff it appropriately. So I just want to say there are a lot of things that could be done to make the experience better for the donors and definitely to pay them more, because we all knew that they were making quite a lot of money.
Jay, thank you so much for calling. I do appreciate that. That comparison to cattle, that comes up a lot, Kathleen.
Yeah, I have heard that so many times, that people who donate often feel like livestock, and that it is an industry that's very similar to agriculture. And when you go inside a plasma center, you can see what they're talking about. You know, you have these rows of recliner chairs set up side by side. People are sitting in the chairs hooked up to machines. It all feels very sci-fi to me. But I mean, as Jay just said, this is something people have come to depend on. It isn't an industry that just popped up overnight. It's an industry that is embedded in American society. And, you know, we have lost so much of our social safety net in the last 30 to 40 years. This is an endeavor that has developed into something that has replaced it for people. So where the cost of living has gone crazy, this selling plasma is something that people can do to make ends meet. And it's just, you know, it's like a lot of times plasma centers are in the same strip malls as a dollar store or other businesses that kind of prey on economic precarity. And you can really see it by the places they're located. And these are the types of industries, I think, that have bloomed in the United States as our economic divide has widened. So it is definitely something that people depend on.
So the fact that people have to feel like they have to go there to supplement their income, they're working full time also. It's just that their full-time job isn't quite enough, Kathleen. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a story I heard from a lot of people, that they were making enough, but just not quite enough to get by. So people would use it for grocery money. There were people who sell plasma to pay for a vacation, you know, because they make enough money maybe to get by, but not enough money to have any fun. There are people who use it to pay off student debt. There are people who use it for all sorts of things.
Right. You're right about one person in Texas who used it to pay off their speeding tickets.
Yeah, she was very interesting. She had gotten into a real bind with court fees and fines. And because she lost her driver's license, she wasn't able to work because she couldn't get to and from a job. And this was the way that she found to pay off her court fees. And she said something to me that has really stuck with me. And she said it twice. She said, "I would sell a kidney if I could."
But you can't.
And you just have to wonder why we've drawn this line that this is what you can sell and this is what you can't.
We'll get into that when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open. Definitely want to hear from listeners who have sold their plasma, people who need the plasma to keep the, you know, it's a medicine. They make medicine out of this. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're going to be right back. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Big Sun Solar, committed to helping businesses strive towards energy independence and conservation. Solar is a great way for businesses to lower their carbon footprint. More at BigSunSolar.com/TPR.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. According to the book Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry, in San Antonio, there are 16 commercial plasma centers. In Brownsville and McAllen area, there are 13 in El Paso, Las Cruces. That's a lot given the size of these areas, and it shows that these are areas that are economically stressed, and that's where we see a lot of these plasma centers popping up. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're speaking with the author, Kathleen McLaughlin. She is joining us. And also, let's get a caller in on this. Let's go to Christopher. And Christopher, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much. Kathleen, I look forward to picking up your book. While y'all were talking, it got me about med school. We would always go down to the Texas Blood Bank and donate platelets because it takes 2.5 hours and forces to study. But listening to all about all the plasma centers, I was curious, has the blood bank had to change the way it does things? Because platelets don't last forever. They're just as important as plasma, if more so during surgeries. But if all the people donating are going to plasma centers where they can pay, what happens to the blood bank and the platelets that need to be collected from there?
All right, Christopher, he was fading in and out. So, Kathleen, did you catch all that?
I think I did. I think he's asking if there is a shortage of people who are donating platelets and blood because people are going to the plasma centers instead.
Yes.
Was that sort of upshot? Yeah, so I think so. I think that you're looking at different demographics maybe here. There are always people who are going to donate blood and platelets at the Red Cross because that's just something that they have kind of learned to do and enjoy doing for, and they can afford to be purely altruistic. The plasma industry is really instead, I think, targeting people who need the money. So of all the people that I interviewed, the number one reason they gave me for donating plasma in these settings is money. There is definitely a secondary aspect to it that allows people who don't have a lot of extra money to give back to society, but the primary reason is financial. So I think they're not targeting the same populations here. And I haven't seen any evidence that the plasma industry is taking away blood or platelet donors. But it is an interesting question. I've thought about that. I do think it's targeting different populations. And in terms of where the substance is going, the thing that I think is very important to recognize about the plasma industry is a lot of this plasma is being exported because there are only 5 countries in the world that allow people to be paid for plasma. And the U.S. by far has the largest population among those 5 countries. We have become a major exporter of this substance to other countries that don't have as much plasma of their own.
So a continental Europe, there's no country there that will allow people to sell plasma. So they're very much dependent upon the United States. And isn't the biggest corporation in this industry is Spanish owned, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that's interesting about the industry is that it is very much multinational, international industry. So one of the companies is Spanish, one of the companies is Australian, you know, and then you're reaching across from, it's not just Americans involved in the plasma industry in the U.S., it's also Mexican citizens. In that lawsuit that we were talking about earlier over the border, the Mexican border plasma stations were described as the most productive in the United States. So those to the industry, according to these court documents, are the most important plasma centers in their industry because they attract so many people from Mexico.
And so we talked about this as a labor issue, and you write about this in the book as well as how long time ago in New York there was kind of a talk of a union. I mean, what if everyone in the United States who typically gives plasma decided they can organize on social media in kind of an informal way and say, you know what, this week we're going to go on strike and we're going to see about raising the wage, raising the price they have a precious commodity. What if everyone said, you know, we're going to hold back until we can get the prices raised? That could happen, couldn't it?
I mean, there's great power in collective action. So what happened 100 years ago in New York when blood transfusion was a one-to-one proposition. So if you needed a blood transfusion, you needed a human being on hand to get the blood. When blood banking came around, that changed the process. But when blood donors were expected to show up the hospital on a moment's notice, it was a profession. And they actually formed a union in New York for a short period of time. I think it lasted about a year. They were a chapter of the AFL. So it wasn't just an idea of a union. They really were a union. And the idea was to protect their wages, to protect their working conditions, and all things that a union would do. I don't know if that's possible today with plasma donors, but I think there is great power in collective action. Part of the problem right now, I think, is because the practice is somewhat marginalized. There isn't a lot of discussion among plasma donors themselves on how to improve it or what discussion they're having isn't in the public sphere and isn't getting maybe the attention it should be. So I think that all of these things could be great to push back a little bit and say, hey, we are the reason you have this massive industry. Let's talk about what would make it better for us.
Let's go to a caller. We have Scott on the line. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. I appreciate you taking my call. So I'm a regular blood donor. I donate every 8 weeks. It's kind of like an oil change. This year I'll hit 20 gallons. And that's great because I'm willing to do it for free. But the reality is that there's not enough people that do that. So the paid industry comes up. And my question is, and I have some friends who work for that Spanish company you were referencing. They have a big office in San Antonio. And I know that from that industry that they have many, many people that are making strong living wages. And I guess the question becomes in economics is, if we pay more at the beginning, how is that going to affect the end? Is her $13,000 a month medicine going to go up because it's going to have that trickle effect all the way up to?
Okay. Scott, thank you so much for that great call. I appreciate it. So Kathleen, let's say they doubled the price for paying people for donating plasma. You know, I just made that up. But say they doubled it. How would that impact what you would have to pay? They're not going to double to the $13,000 that you pay for a dose of your life-saving medication, would they?
No, I mean, it's a very interesting question. I appreciate that. So the cost of my medication goes up every year anyway. So my medication last year was $12,000 a dose. This year it's $13,000. So that's happening anyway. I think 4 years ago it was $8,000 a dose. So the cost of my medication is always going up. I would say what we need to look at is not the wages and salaries that people are making within the industry, because that is important. No one who's working as a phlebotomist in a plasma clinic is getting rich off of it. I think where we need to look is the profits and find out who's making the profits and how much. And do we want a profit-centered healthcare industry? And that's what we have in every part of American healthcare, right, is the ability for a small number of people to make profit off of it. And I think that that's where the ethical concern comes in, is who is actually making a lot of profit off of this? And should they maybe be making less profit off of something that is life-saving?
So congratulations to Scott. You know, you're awesome for being such a great donor for blood. When I would go to give blood at the San Antonio Blood and Tissue Center, I got treated really well. I mean, there's pizza, there's lots of juice and different types of stuff to drink. Sometimes they give you a little reward. I'd get an HEB, a local grocer gift card, maybe for $10 or so. But you don't get that when you are at the plasma center. They don't give you cookies and juice unless you're, having some sort of conniption, do they, Kathleen?
No, they don't. They will keep some stuff on hand and they'll give it to someone if they're about to faint after a donation. So there isn't, it's a much, let's say, colder endeavor than donating blood. When you donate blood, it's really valorized. You are a hero. You know, you get these little treats and rewards. When you donate plasma, you do get the financial reward, but you don't get these little things that might just be kindness,
yeah, but that's because they're nickel and diming. They're you know, they're nickel and diming folks.
Exactly.
So I got a text message from a caller. So,
yeah.
He said, last time I donated, after half an hour, I fainted and a bottle of water was brought me back to life. So that's
wow.
Something that the... you know, caller, the text messenger listener, you know, pointed out. And so, and also I got another message saying, I donated plasma to get an analysis of my blood. Do you get an analysis when you donate plasma?
You do. And I have heard, from one person that I interviewed during this reporting that the health check they get from the plasma center was as close as they've come to having an actual physical in years. Because healthcare, basic healthcare, is too expensive in America. So for some people, getting this little health check is the closest they get to having medical care. So there are a lot of layers wrapped into it.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation talking about the plasma industry in America. We're going to ask about how did COVID change things? And if you got a question, call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Back in 1 minute. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the book Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry, joined by the author Kathleen McLaughlin. And you can call in with your questions or comments if you have been a person who've sold plasma. How did that work out for you? Would you recommend it? Would you want your kids to do that? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Then came COVID. You tell a story about some college kids who deliberately got COVID because they thought it would make their plasma raise the price. Is that right?
Well, the pandemic did some very interesting things. So before vaccines, before there was any kind of good treatment for COVID, we were sort of throwing things at the wall, looking for anything that would make the disease less deadly and less dangerous to people. One of the things that the federal government poured a lot of money into was something called convalescent plasma treatment. And that's rooted in science. It's something that goes back many decades, this idea of taking the blood plasma of someone who's recovered from a disease and they have antibodies to treat someone who has the disease. So you're basically giving them the strength of someone else's antibodies. So blood plasma from people who had recovered from COVID did become more valuable. There were higher payments in many places. If you could go to a plasma center and prove that you'd had COVID, you would earn more money. And this was a federally funded endeavor. So one of the places I reported is a little town called Rexburg, Idaho. And a few months into the pandemic, the administration at the big university there, Brigham Young University, Idaho, put out a warning letter to students saying, do not try to get COVID deliberately. We have had reports of students attempting to contract COVID so that they could sell their plasma for more money. Now, Rexburg is a really interesting and unusual place. It is almost entirely Mormon. It is, I think, 95% Mormon. They have two plasma centers in a town that only has about 35,000 people, which is a really big number of centers. It is predominantly college students who are selling plasma there. And it just isn't that stigmatized in Rexburg compared to other places. People are pretty open about it. They don't think it's that big of a deal. So I think when it came along, the idea that they could make a lot more money with COVID plasma, that these college kids who were told that COVID wasn't that dangerous to them because they were young, felt like, okay, whatever, let's do this. So I never found the people who attempted to deliberately get COVID, but everyone I interviewed basically said, yeah, it's definitely plausible. We're sure someone did this. And it was serious enough that the university itself put out a warning to students telling them not to do this.
Does everything that we put plasma into need to be there? I've heard that we use it in cosmetics to tell people this will help reduce wrinkles, but does it really work?
So the majority of plasma is used for life-saving medications. There is a lot that goes toward research and other purposes. The more kind of, I would say, unproven or potentially frivolous uses of plasma tend to come from companies that are doing something else or doing experimental things. So for example, Ambrosia, which has kind of been marginalized and shut down, was collecting plasma from different sources, not these major companies that are the majority of the industry. So, and when you do a vampire facial like Kim Kardashian did a few years ago, they're actually using your own blood plasma to make that happen. So we have these notions around blood and plasma, but most of the plasma that is collected in these private companies is actually going for medical purposes.
Now, you write a lot about China. You write about how when you were a reporter in China for 15 years, you had to smuggle in your own plasma from the United States. That's a whole thing. People need to read about that. That's really cool in the book. It's not, but China had a huge plasma HIV scare. There's a lot we could learn from that experience and how we should protect our own plasma industry and the people who depend on that, shouldn't we?
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. So like you said, I lived in China for 15 years. And in that time, I knew that their blood and plasma industry was not entirely safe. They had had a massive scandal in the 90s when they tried to create something called the plasma economy. And their plan was to take the plasma of poor people and turn it into an export product. And the reason they thought this was a good idea was China did not have a high incidence of HIV and AIDS, whereas the rest of the world did. Unfortunately, HIV got into the plasma system and thousands of people were infected and died from it. So I was kind of fascinated by this idea of the government or private industry creating something called the plasma economy. It felt very dystopian and weird to me that a country would do this deliberately, that they would prey on the plasma of people who needed money. And then when I came back to the U.S., I found out that the United States had created the plasma economy without very many people noticing. The difference, I think, in our industry right now is that it is much safer to donors and recipients because medical science has advanced greatly since then. But we're still doing the same thing that China had intended to do, which is pay poor people for their blood parts. So I'm not sure that we're that much different in that way.
Let's take a moment to honor the woman who was the whistleblower that you write about.
Yeah, Wang Shuping. She worked in the plasma economy in China. She was a medical researcher who monitored the health of Chinese plasma donors. And she noticed a high incidence of hepatitis C among donors. And she knew that HIV often traveled in pairs with hepatitis C. So she started testing plasma donors in China and found HIV in the system. She alerted all of her superiors. She alerted the central government in Beijing. It still took 3 months to get the system shut down. And she was threatened. She was physically beat up. Her family was intimidated. She fled to the United States and eventually ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah, where she was a cancer researcher. And that's where I met her 25 years after the AIDS catastrophe in China. We spent a lot of time together. She was an amazing woman. just brilliant, but also had the brightest personality. Her English name was Sunshine, which really captured her entire personality. Unfortunately, the Chinese government continued to harass her. And there was a woman who put on a musical about Wang Shuping's life in London in 2019. The Chinese government tried to get it shut down. They were unsuccessful, but they were still trying to intimidate her family back in China. And unfortunately, not long after the play premiered, she was out hiking with her husband in the mountains outside of Salt Lake and had a heart attack and died. So she's no longer with us. And this book is really kind of a tribute to her and her work.
Let's go to a caller. Carl is on the phone. Carl, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm a plasmic donor and here in San Antonio. And a while back when I was at some sales up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the St. Paul area near the college, they weren't giving cash vouchers. They were only giving food vouchers to the kids and the people because of the drug problem.
All right.
That was just a comment. I'll let you go.
Oh, thank you, Carl. Can you give us more on that, Kathleen?
You know, I've not heard of that before. That's very interesting that they'd only be giving food vouchers. I wonder which company that was. But I do know that, you know, a lot of college students do this for grocery money. So it's probably just as attractive to some people as the debit cards would be. I hadn't heard of that before, though, but it doesn't surprise me.
We have a question or a comment from a caller, Robert. He wants to know, is there an age limit, upper age limit to donating? You have to be 18 minimum to donate, but what's the maximum? He is 76.
You know, I haven't heard of a maximum age. My understanding is that you just have to be in good health. So I think if you go into a plasma center and pass the health check, you can do it. I haven't heard of a maximum age, only the minimum age, which, as you said, is 18.
And they do, if you have a lot of tattoos, a lot of piercings, that's something that they use to screen people?
Yeah, it's more recent tattoos. So if you get a new tattoo, you are deferred for several months. You can't donate for several months. You have to have a blood test. You have to pass basic health checks. The other thing that can knock people off from donating is if they get a bad needle stick. So, you know, it's hard to, I think, stick a giant needle in someone's vein twice a week. And if you get a big bruise on your vein or they miss the vein, then you can be deferred from donating. So that is also a financial risk for people as well. There's all sorts of things that can kind of knock people out of the system.
So it seemed like the takeaway of your book is this is the system. There's a lot of good that comes out of the system. It's got some troubling aspects of it. It could be made better. Is that it?
I think so. I think that we have failed to consider the risks to people. I think we need more long-term scientific study about the potential health risk of frequent long-term donation. And I think that people should be treated better. But I have come to see this industry as a symptom of what's wrong with America rather than the exact problem itself. So if we had higher wages, if the cost of education wasn't so high, we wouldn't have millions of people who felt compelled to sell their plasma every week.
Kathleen McLaughlin is the author of Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies, with production support from Kayla Padilla and Mark Hutchison. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. Support for The Source comes from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.